Good evening, everyone. Before I begin, I know a few people have said there are physical ailments, backaches, etc., and you may be lying down for that reason. If that's the case, please take care of your body. If you let us know for a physical reason that you need to do so, but I would be very much supported if others could be in the sitting posture, and that would support me in terms of feeling some of the energization after what's also been a long day for me. And please say if you can't hear me, I'll try and speak loudly. It's easy to forget that it's a big hall. So I've been having this feeling, it's not quite deja vu, but this sense of familiarity and repetition we've been talking about there from last year. It's the same teaching team and it's the same manager team. And there's a lot of people who were here last year as well. And it feels like, we just skipped a year and kind of come back. But then everything also feels a little bit different. So it's an interesting perception to hold in terms of this retreat. And I was especially thinking of it because I think I offered the talk on last year's second evening, and looking at my notes, it's the evening of the second full day. I wonder how you're doing, which I said about a year ago to somewhat the same group. It's also a very strange question to put on a silent retreat to a group of 50 people, because there's going to be a lot of variety and not really an opportunity to answer, but I am very curious how it's going for each of you, and have a little bit of sense. And sometimes it can be worth stating the obvious and reminding ourselves arriving on retreat is a gradual process. It's an organic process, and I'm reminding myself as much as I'm reminding you, including myself in on this. I'm really feeling it, sensing it myself, feeling gradually more fully here, more fully arrived. I think there's something quite interesting. We live in quite a fast-paced world where a lot of things are immediate, and then the movements of the mind, the movements of the heart can be more gradual. It takes us time to arrive, to acclimatize, to get here on retreat. The body is here, but then the rest of us takes a little time to catch up. And sometimes it can be helpful to name that, because there can be a little bit of impatience at times, like why is it like this? This is part of the process of adjustment and arriving, transition. And I know that there are a number of people who've done a lot of practice before, or are familiar with the Buddhist tradition. And I know many of you are also familiar how the Buddhist tradition has what we could call quite a sophisticated meditative psychology. That's part of the teachings, a meditative psychology, mapping out sort of different, we could say, states of meditative consciousness and guiding the practitioner through deepening pathways of practice. There's a beauty, that's an aspect of the teachings that is available to us. And in addition to the psychology, you may be aware of nuanced philosophical frameworks, philosophies arising from meditative experience and insight, offering views, philosophical views, meditative views that we can bring to our practice, explore different conceptions which can actually, in important ways, nourish and contribute to our meditative opening and deepening. Understanding the nature of perception, the nature of consciousness, these are also central questions. Might feel far away and lofty at times. These are actually central questions within the Buddhist tradition. And alongside both of these, there exists something which we could say is equally profound as a vehicle of teaching, but at times overlooked. And that's the rich culture of storytelling, of folk wisdom and teaching stories, which have been actually passed down through millennia, through generations, holding important practice ideas. And these stories often find striking ways of conveying philosophical and meditative ideas and truths and principles, offering psychological insight through different kinds of images and scenes and stories, metaphors. And in this evening's story, I'd like to begin by exploring one such story, a scene from the moment of the Buddha's awakening, something that James touched on last night in yesterday's talk. And there's, I think as was said, there's different versions or there's slightly different images of the Buddha's awakening. There's different philosophies actually around it as well. And this particular version doesn't come from the Pali Canon itself, which is the body of the early teachings of Buddhism, but comes from what's called the Nidanakatha, which is a, we could say, an important predecessor to a collection of texts called the Jataka Tales, which are a collection of about over 500 stories from the Buddhist tradition about the Buddha's previous lives. And the Jataka stories actually exist as children's stories in a lot of original Buddhist cultures still, and are continue to be told. So I'm just saying that's part of the genre, as you'll discover as we go into the story. It has some of that aesthetic, we could say. So one of the first, just to give a little context, one of the first English translators of the Nidanakatha, Rhys Davies, notes, writes, "In the first place, the fairy tales, parables, fables, riddles, and comic and moral stories of which the Buddhist collection, known as the Jataka book, consists, have been found in many instances to bear a striking resemblance to similar ones current in the West." Well, stories have a similarity to stories that we know. Now, in many instances, this resemblance is simply due to the fact that the Western stories were borrowed from the Buddhist ones. So this is just a little bit of interesting cultural context. Actually, if we reflect on it, the spread and translation of these stories and these tales across cultures and continents is a kind of testament to how, to their power, to how they resonate in the human imagination, how important stories are important for us. Stories are important. It's a, stories are a way in which we make sense of our lives, of ourselves, of others, of our place in the world, and also of our meditation practice and what that's about. And that's central to this, this particular story and the scene we'll go into. And according to this particular story, the Buddha-to-be is sitting famously beneath the Bodhi tree with this resolve for awakening, deciding, okay, I'm not going to move, I'm going to stay here, I want to deepen my, my meditative understanding and work towards the possibility of awakening. When Mara approaches, as we heard yesterday a little bit. So Mara is often described in the tradition as a kind of, we could say, malevolent figure, a tempter or a disruptor of practice, someone who wants to disturb us as we're sitting in meditation, wants to come and push the meditator off the seat. And more deeply, we can understand Mara as a kind of archetypal figure, archetypal personification. It's a figure for the various unskillful tendencies of the mind. We'd say doubt and uncertainty, fear, craving, delusion, irritability, all of the things, whatever whatever the things are that catch us, that we get caught up in when we're practicing. It can be a question, how has Mara arisen today for each one? Probably in many, many guises, in many ways. And I said earlier that this is from the predecessor to the Jatakas, they're kind of children's stories. So the Buddha realizes Mara is approaching. He sees him in the distance and he says, this is a quote from the original text, "My mother and father, my relatives are not here to help me. I must rely on the 10 perfections, the paramis. They will be my shield and sword against Mara." So probably resonates more fully with a younger audience for the Buddha to say, "My mum and dad are not here to help me. I'm gonna rely on these practices, but then the 10 paramis to support myself in this difficult situation." And the paramis were also touched on yesterday in James's beautiful talk, the 10 perfections. Qualities of the heart and mind, which when developed, when cultivated, when we give them attention, they really support our practice, support our steadiness, our deepening, support the meditative well-being, support the heart, and profound support in that way. And there's actually a number of qualities we have already been practicing with. So the first one is dana parami. Generosity, the giving of oneself to practice. Sila, virtue, morality. We talked about the five precepts as a ground for practice. This intention towards non-harming as a kind of a basis for our practice, as a commitment that we all enter into. This is one of the paramis. Kanti, patience, tolerance, forbearance, endurance. Again, patience was a quality named yesterday and today. Something that we really notice, we need it, it makes a difference. Certainly notice when it's not there. I notice for myself when the opposite of it is around, the impatience, the frustration. And metta, kindness, friendliness, loving kindness. That's just to mention a few that we've actually been practicing with and touching on. So in this story, Mara says to his cohort, his gang, he says out his intentions, "I'm going to overwhelm this person. I'm going to drive him away. I'm going to slay him." And so he declares his intention, and this is followed by, in the sort of style and genre of this text, by several very dramatic stanzas describing his onslaught on the Buddha. I won't read them all because there was a lot, but here are a selection of, this is kind of the superhero movie from 2,600 years ago in poetry mode, genre. Description of Mara. "Then he raised a storm of deadly weapons, and they came, one-edged and two-edged swords, and spears and arrows, smoking and flaming through the sky. But as they reached the great being, the Buddha, they became flowers from heaven. Then he raised a stone of charcoal, but the embers, though they came through the sky as red kimsuka flowers, were scattered at the feet of the future Buddha as heavenly flowers. Then he raised a storm of ashes, and the ashes came through the air, exceeding hot and in color like fire, but they fell at the feet of the future Buddha as the dust of sandalwood. Then he raised a storm of mud, and the mud came smoking and flaming through the air, but it fell at the feet of the future Buddha as heavenly perfume." So the mud is my favorite. There's something relatable about that, flaming mud on the first few days of retreat. Whatever the version of that is, we can interpret the poetry to our own experience. It could be easy if we read a story like this and think of it, I'm going to read it through a lens of historical realism, we would be very quick to reject it. It wouldn't have much to offer us. It feels like, okay, this is a fantasy story of a hero and this kind of encounter. Trying to read these stanzas as objective descriptions is going to fail. So we have to look at them more as, okay, what's the level on which they're speaking to us? What's the level that's helpful? And it feels obvious this teaching story is not concerned with being literal or a description of material events. It's a metaphor pointing towards actually a meditative experience or to the nature of perception, we could say. It's pointing to the lived experience, to the phenomenological. And truth about the nature of perception or an experiential dynamic inviting exploration in our hearts and minds. So we can take this scene as speaking of the possibility of transformation of perception. Transformation of perception. There's something that's perceived as difficult, problematic, hot, sharp, muddy. And this is somehow transformed through the practice, through the qualities of the heart, through the way of looking, through the way of seeing. There's a transformation, possibility of a transformation of perception through more, we could say, awakened or skillful or more of a practice view. It opens up another way of looking, and the whole experience is transformed through that, made possible through the practice of the paramis. This is what will protect me from Mara, the Buddha says. And in the practice, that which appears harmful, threatening, and dangerous is actually revealed to be harmless, and even as light, as beautiful, as nourishing. So maybe just to pause with that and see, is there a way of recognizing some of that on some subtle way in the practice over the past few days? So I'm just thinking of my own practice. James, you were guiding the self-compassion and just noticing the transformation of when I brought my hand to rest on the face, connecting to that sense of kindness, gentleness, support. Something softened in the heart, in the experience. There was a subtle transformation of perception. There was a shift there, an attunement. It was that part of the practice made something possible. And it's like, actually, there's a little softening. It wasn't maybe the full-blown rain of heavenly flowers that opened, but there was a little scent of something, a sense of possibility, sense of compassion. Some hardness softened there. And it could be anything. It could be mindfulness, it could be metta, it could be a moment of letting go that allows for a transformation of perception to open up. And part of what this story is saying, the implied understanding here is that perception is not a fixed window onto reality as it is. Perception is not a fixed view or a fixed window onto reality. It's a dependent arising, to borrow a little bit from the philosophical, the psychological language of the Buddha. There's a dependency on what am I bringing? What am I bringing? What are the qualities of heart that I'm bringing? What are the views, the ways of understanding that I'm bringing to my experience? And what kind of impact does that have? How does Mara get transformed into something else? The way we view things, the qualities of heart and mind, we inevitably bring to our experience. And as we will bring something. I'll bring my impatience or irritability. If I think about the past couple of days of adjusting and arriving here, those have been qualities, or my tiredness, and they become lenses. They become lenses onto experience, fabricating that. It's like, there's Mara arising, seen through, sensed through those qualities. So this is a story about practice. We could take it as a story about practice on this level, this way of interpreting it, inviting us to ask how Mara is arising in my life, in my practice, in my moment-to-moment meditation here on retreat today. What's the current mudstorm that's arising, that's raining down, and how am I receiving it? What's the quality that I'm bringing to it? And is there some possibility of transformation of something? Maybe some shift of the heart. And of course, we know it's not always possible. There's going to be lots of times when the qualities feel like they're far away, the helpful qualities, especially in the first days of retreat. So it's not like, I'm not saying it's always accessible. Certainly hasn't been my experience. Sometimes we just get the mudstorm. And that's we can try maneuver and practice in other ways. And that's what's available to us. And other times, other moments, we know there's the possibility of some kind of transformation. So we can take that as a kind of metaphor that we can reflect on for our practice. And speaking of these different storms of the mind, there's a very useful word in the Pali language that refers to problematic forms of thinking, mental habits that we could say generate or fabricate suffering, create, give rise to suffering, to difficulty, complications and complexity. And that word is papancha in the Pali. I don't think it has a kind of obvious English translation. Maybe rumination is something close to it, but it's kind of problematic thinking, we could say. The kind of thinking that creates suffering and involves the self. The self gets pulled in through this kind of thinking. And we could translate it, could be translated in a few different ways. An interesting one I heard is objectification. Through papancha, things are turned into objects, into more solidity is made, is given to objects. Could also be translated as distortion or exaggeration. Distortion in that is sort of distorts how we're seeing things, how we're seeing ourselves and what happens. Or exaggeration, it's like the mind hypes up the problem, makes a much bigger problem out of something than what it needs to be. And in the context of papancha, we can speak of habits like the inner critic. Such an important theme, such an important theme to practice with and to speak about and to recognize on retreat. The momentum of criticizing the self, the momentum of thinking that criticizes the self, berating the self with judgmental thoughts, unnecessary harshness, evaluating, measuring, devaluing of oneself. I mean, very, very, very painful habit and not at all uncommon. Somehow it feels like it's culturally endemic. It's very typical for it to arise under certain circumstances. And often this kind of inner critic ties in with ideals or demands about how we think we should be. So there's some ideal of how we should be. And it's very easy for us to attune to ideals like that through meditation practice. It's like we talk about the 10 perfections. You know, there's this idea of like, oh, there's these 10 qualities that need to be perfect in myself. or it's like it's possible to hear that, even the word perfection in relation to mental qualities. It's raising the bar quite high. It's easy to judge and evaluate one's own meditation practice, mindfulness, samadhi, understanding, heartfulness. All of these can become sort of objects of evaluation and criticism. So can tie in with ideals or demands of how we think we should be, can also be related to tendencies of perfectionism. Again, this sort of internalized idea of, oh, I really need to be in a particular way. My meditation practice on a retreat needs to be perfect in some way. So important to recognize if that's there as a view, or so helpful to recognize that as a view, so that we can begin to unhook something, let go of something. This kind of thinking can also involve imagined concerns about what others may think of us, worries or anxieties about others' opinions. What is this person, or what is that person thinking? How do they see me? And the mind gets wrapped up with that concern. And I think very understandably, I think we're, as a species, we're deeply, deeply social beings. It's mattered greatly throughout our evolution what other members of the social group think of us. How do others see me? That can perhaps, you know, over the millennia, at times, that's been an integral question. How do others see me? How am I seen? How am I perceived? And these patterns of thought can live deep within us. And actually, I think, and there's research to indicate, can be magnified by some of the technologies that we use that are very much about the making the self visible to the world. We live in a time where that's such a sort of cultural, there's a strong cultural momentum to being seen in particular ways, performing. And sometimes it's just helpful to articulate this and notice, oh, it's not about me. It's actually a bigger, perhaps evolutionary, perhaps cultural phenomena that I'm experiencing. And papancha can also be directed outwards, beyond the self. So we might find ourselves habitually identifying problems in everything outside, in the external things. So on a retreat like this, perhaps you've sat retreats elsewhere, and it's easy to notice, like, ah, oh, this is a little bit off. This is a little different from the other retreat I was at. You know, the aircon, the food, the house, the accommodation, the teachings, the yogis. It's like the mind can, when it goes, switches onto a certain position, it's like it can go on a kind of a fault-finding mission and just see, like, ah, there's a problem. I'm dissatisfied with this. There's also a momentum of papancha, habitually identifying problems in everything outside. And this is a kind of, we could call this an internal habit of complaining or negativity. The mind is just sort of goes on that track of negativity, habitual negativity. I've sometimes wondered, certainly, you know, I'm speaking from experience with all of these. I have experience with all of these, and I've wondered sometimes whether this might be the shadow side of our culture's educational system, emphasis on critical thinking. We really develop and are trained to develop the capacity to scrutinize, to problematize, to find problems in things, and this kind of critical thinking. Notice flaws, take apart things, criticize. And have wondered whether this capacity can become very well developed, highly trained, and can kind of just become second nature. That sort of, it just kind of stays on. Becomes kind of unconsciously a dominant mode of thinking and being. I'm finding the problem in everything. And a habit that lingers into other areas of life without us realizing it. And really, to be clear, personally, I think the kind of critical thinking that, you know, we can be trained in is extremely valuable and necessary. And I think in such, so necessary if we look at the world and the times that we're living in. And I think it's actually also important that we find ways of integrating that into our Dharma practice to bring that sort of critical, bright intelligence into our practice, into the Dharma, into how we look at things. And we need to be able to put it down when it sort of runs away so that it's not driving the whole show. So not wanting to be unnecessarily anti-intellectual or anti-thought here, but I think it's necessary that we can discern between these different modes of thinking when the mind is problematizing in a way that creates unnecessary suffering. That's really what Papancha is talking about. And Papancha can also include catastrophizing, where the mind creates, spins up some worst case scenario, a kind of worry. I don't know if you recognize this from the past few days. You're sitting there, there's not a lot happening on the meditation retreat, and the mind says, imagine if this thing happens. It's like, imagine your life falls apart spectacularly in this way. What are you going to do then? It's like the offer of the mind is, if you think about it, maybe it's not going to happen. That's the promise of catastrophizing. That's the promise of this mode of papancha. And again, I've said this before. I've sat a lot of long retreats, a number of 3-month retreats. A good chunk of that was devoted to worrying and papancha, and I can testify it didn't lead anywhere. I didn't avoid any big disasters despite worrying very effectively about things. So worth considering. It's probably not going to serve you very well. So papancha is a kind of a broad umbrella term that includes many forms of thinking, and I've sort of wanted to emphasize, mention a number of them, typically really problematic ones. And you might recognize more. You might recognize a certain kind of planning, obsessive planning, or whatever it is, or other forms of papancha that haven't been mentioned here. But it's the power of that concept is really in recognizing it, noticing it, like, okay, now the mind's running away with this kind of thinking. Now the mind's running away with this kind of thinking. And it's like it's creating more tension, more difficulty, more emotion, more anxiety. This is typical with this kind of thinking. It's charged with emotion. Papancha is not usually a kind of neutral reflection of like, my life could fall apart in this way. Interesting. We could try and bring that quality. I think, James, you alluded to that yesterday in saying, you know, we can, what if we bring the interest and the curiosity to these forms of thinking? But typically, it's actually quite charged with emotion, difficulty and anxiety. And typically also involves some kind of narrative about the self. I won't go much into this theme, but just to say, the self is created through the papancha, the self story. In Buddha Dharma, in Buddhist psychology, there's a very intricate understanding of how the self, the sense of self is fabricated. And one way in which it's fabricated is through the stories. Stories we tell of ourselves, of others, selves and others are created through the papancha. This is how I see myself. This is how I see another. And we can look and reflect on the past day. What kinds of dramas have arisen? What kind of self stories have come up through the day. So that's papancha, some kind of introduction to it, and something that we're practicing with. And it often arises together with what are referred to as the five hindrances. So it's interesting, when you read the collection of the early teachings of the Buddha, there's a theme that gets talked about a lot, typically before any more in-depth meditation instructions. The Buddha would offer some instruction, some teaching on the hindrances. They repeat throughout the Pali Canon, different obstacles to practice. And actually, it can be helpful to reflect on this. So already 2,500, 2,600 years ago, as people were engaging in serious, committed meditation practice, putting time aside for cultivation of meditation, going on retreat, wanting to deepen understanding and insight and awakening, they were also noticing that practicing meditation in this way at times is really hard. It's really difficult. Actually, I've heard of this possibility of meditative awakening, insight, understanding, liberation, all of those things, and I come to practice, and what do I find in myself? I find desire, wanting, irritability, hatred, anger, tiredness, fogginess, restlessness, worry, doubt. And that's actually what I'm sitting with. And so it's helpful for us to know that this is actually something quite universal, that the Buddhist tradition really says over and over again, you're going to find this when you come to practice. And this is part of what we will be practicing with. As part of the reality of practice. Because sometimes it's easy to think, you know, one sits down and close your eyes and you think, oh, it's just my mind that's so crazy with the papancha, with the hindrances, with the difficulties. No, they've been talked about and written about for 2,600 years, probably longer. This is just the sort of historical trajectory of the Buddhist tradition. So that can be a helpful aspect of normalizing these experiences, normalizing these qualities in our selves as well. And actually, one of the ways in which the hindrances are talked about is as their mara, an embodiment, a kind of an aspect of mara. So if we come back to that story of transformation, we can reflect on that. There's actually a possibility of transformation of the hindrances as well through practice. And the Buddha actually talks about the hindrances through terms of feeding and not feeding. So the idea is that in practice we can feed the helpful qualities, feed the patience, the settledness, the sense of peace, the mindfulness, that we keep coming back to the kindness, the self-compassion, in all these small gestures that have been mentioned, opening up the attention to the whole field of the body, we can keep feeding that mindfulness and avoid feeding that which doesn't support meditative deepening. Just checking how well I'm doing for time. So I'll say a little bit about each of the five hindrances, just naming them. So the first of the five is desire. So desire can be desire for anything. Can be sensual or sexual desire, can be desire for food. Typically it's talked about as desire for sense pleasure. The mind brings up some image or some idea or some thought. This is what I want. And there's the promise of pleasure, of something being delivered through that gratification of the desire. Desire to be somewhere else, to be doing something else. Desire for something or some person. So the first thing to say, when we talk about desire in this way, desire as a hindrance, And especially when we talk about sexual desire as a hindrance, our intention, my intention, is not to bring some moralistic judgment onto sexual desire. It's not a kind of a value judgment of this is bad or sinful or problematic on a kind of existential level. Or that we should get rid of it entirely in our lives, live without it. We could say, if we clarify the intention, if we look at desire, relationship to desire, on a retreat like this, practicing in these ways, whilst practicing on retreat, being unconsciously caught up in the movement of desire is probably generally not going to support the cultivation and development of mindfulness, of compassion, of clarity, of insight, of samadhi. So being caught up unconsciously in that movement of desire, it's not going to support that movement of practice and that deepening. It's not, we don't have to reject it wholesale. We can say, okay, this is a part of my life, and when I'm here, I recognize, I notice, okay, this is happening. And as I said, the Buddha says, talks about feeding and not feeding. And this is a quote from, again, the Pali Canon, the early teachings. And what is the food for the arising of unarisen sensual desire, or for the growth and increase of sensual desire once it has arisen? So what leads to the coming up of desire or stokes it? Once you have a little bit of desire, what keeps it going or increases it? To foster inappropriate attention to it. This is the food for the arising and unarisen sensual desire. So you stay with whatever daydream, fantasy, image, whatever it is of the object of desire, you stay with that. And that's the feeding of the desire. What can be helpful here is simply, with all of the hindrances, simply recognizing. Again, yesterday, exploring the theme of mindfulness, of noticing, like, this is what's happening. And this might sound like such an obvious one, like, of course I know, but there's actually mindfulness, practicing mindfulness, we notice there's levels of knowing, levels of recognizing something. So it's kind of like, I can kind of know that there's one of the hindrances operating, I can kind of know desires there. But then really to make it an object, really bring your wholehearted curiosity, kindness, interest. And it's like, how does it actually feel? How does it feel in the body? What is the mind doing? Can I really notice this? Can I really recognize it? Sometimes there can be that promise of pleasure in desire and in the fantasy. It's like the fantasy feels good. It promises some payoff, some outcome. Reflecting on where will it take me if I stay with this desire for this meditation practice. This is for all of the hindrances, but can be very useful for desire. You know, it's like, okay, if I keep daydreaming about this, the time is going to pass. But again, it's not really what I signed up for. Probably you didn't come here to sort of say and daydream about whatever object of desire the mind is bringing up. So sort of having that clarity, okay, this is not what I'm really deeply interested in. There's other things that are deeper. There's a deeper possibility of meditation, of opening. This is called reflecting on the drawbacks in the early tradition. Another aspect that can be helpful, coming back to the experience, the sense of the body. So this morning, the instructions were how to open up the attention to the body. Kirsten led a beautiful guided meditation, offered instruction around this. So, so helpful with desire, really coming to the body with all of the hindrances. The papancha is activated, the mind is activated. So we're really coming back to the body, sensing the body. And actually, with desire, quite often, if we examine closely, there can be a pleasant vedana in the desire. It's like that leaves, there's like within the fantasy, within the promise of it, there's something pleasant in that. And we can find that in the body. And this can be a useful way of practicing. It's like you notice that. It's like, oh, let me just stay with the simplicity of the body and the subtle well-being, the subtle pleasure that's there, noticing that, tending to that, and not letting the mind spin into the complexity of thinking. Second of the hindrances, ill will, aversion, irritability, again, a whole range from the subtle kind of dissatisfaction of pushing away something, not feeling so satisfied with the way that the breath is feeling, or with the meditation, or with the sitting, or the walking, to having like a full-on shouting match argument inside your head. You're telling the other person, you know, this is what I wanted to say to that person 3 years ago. And then somehow it comes up in the meditation practice or somewhere in between. So really that's the whole spectrum of ill will and aversion. If it's available, cultivating some sense of kindness, humor was mentioned, really powerful. With the irritability, with the aversion, with the anger, things can get very serious. So bringing some of the kindness, it could just be the compassion of the touch. And again, through the recognition of noticing, like, wow, there's a lot of heat here. There's a lot of irritability. This is difficult. Let me work with this. Let me bring the hand to rest somewhere. There's some kindness, some softening. And again, it might not be the whole mudstorm transformed into sandalwood, but you're looking for, there's actually a sort of incremental shift. It feels a little bit more tolerable when I put my hand here. I'm a little bit more conscious. I'm breathing with it. And that's the path. That's the first step. It's the small steps, the small gestures and acts in meditation. You notice, like, okay, this is a small thing that makes it a little bit more tolerable or less intense in some way. So it could be formal metta practice with kindness, or can just be remembering this attunement to bringing some friendliness to your experience. The third one, tiredness and sluggishness. Again, I don't even have to ask. Such a typical one in the first few days of retreat. As we saw yesterday, we had that nice communal experience of sharing our hindrances. Really, really so typical. There's something in the kind of adjustment from whatever our daily life to sitting and walking. That's just energetically a lot of tiredness can arise. Something in the sitting, walking. Now perhaps also the heat and the humidity. And it can shift. So can often be very tied to the physical body. So we can work on the level of the physical body and just some simple things. Again, they're probably small shifts and gestures are not going to necessarily clear the whole thing away, but can make it a little bit sort of more bearable and possible to practice with, so that you're not completely nodding off and snoring in the meditation hall. So one is just on the level of the posture. We talked about this, just opening up the posture. I notice for myself when there's tiredness, it's just like the posture begins to collapse. There's some kind of curling and shrinking of the spine, and that exacerbates the tiredness, makes it worse. So just having that sense of like, let me really consciously open up, take a posture of openness, of uprightness, opening the eyes, perceiving light can be helpful. So if we're inside, we can go outside and in the walking meditation, really make sure, look at the sky, take it in, take in the sense of spaciousness, the light, let that recharge, feel how that works. Gently elongating the breath, letting it energize. So powerful. The breath is incredible how it's tied in. There's such an alchemy to the breath, to the emotions, to the mind states, to the meditative experience. Such a kind of, often I think, an unexplored science of what the connection between those things are. And gently extending the in-breath, not going to work with just one elongated in-breath, but if you stay with it 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, really letting each in-breath resource, energize, support that energization, you can notice like, something actually shifts. And I'm not talking about a kind of like, you don't have to hyperventilate. It doesn't have to be a full loud movement of the lungs, but just gently extending the in-breath, making sure that you get enough air and oxygen can actually make a big difference. And sometimes just holding an intention, inclining the mind towards alertness and wakefulness with that intention. It's like sometimes with the tiredness, it's like it's easy to get a little bit spacey, and it's like, okay, I still have 10 or 15 minutes in the hall. Let me really try and energize the mind. Usually, you know, off retreat, we'll go for a cup of coffee or whatever it is that we use when we feel tired. But here it's like really extending the in-breath, extending the inhalation, leaning into that, allowing that to support your well-being. Finally, also, if you're suffering with persistent fatigue, I've mentioned this a number of times, some years ago after a long, prolonged COVID infection, I would just crash. I would just crash energetically. It took a long time to recover, and there was a lot of persistent tiredness that I was working with, small exertion leading to just like not being able to do much. Found it very helpful to do some lying down practice and let the attention really come close to the tiredness. We touch the tiredness, rest with the tiredness, staying there for 20 minutes, half an hour, 40 minutes. Actually, something happens through that practice of the attention really becoming one, coming close, staying close, opening to the sense of tiredness. Just putting that out there. I'm not saying it's like this is going to work for anyone else's chronic fatigue, but just sharing that as something that actually really replenished something for me. Didn't fix the whole thing, but it was like, it made it, allowed me to sort of regulate and manage something a little bit so that I was able to be a bit more functional than I would have been otherwise. So trusting, exploring the meditation, who knows what may open up through that. And I'm always careful when talking about working with meditation with medical ailments, because it can be easy to hear like, the meditation will cure everything. So I hope it's clear that's not at all what I'm suggesting, but sometimes for lots of things can actually make things a little bit more bearable, can be helpful in these ways. Okay, two more hindrances and then a poem. Do you still have energy for two more hindrances? Some of you are nodding. Okay, I'll try and be brief. We touched on this restlessness and worry. Again, such a typical momentum of the papancha. Finding a calming breath, using the breath to soothe, can be so helpful. Again, this alchemy, this relationship between the breath and the emotions. The breath can be so powerful for skillful emotional regulation. Stay with the out-breath. Let the out-breath be soft and calming. And again, one out-breath isn't going to do it, but just stay with it. Just like letting everything relax and soften with the out-breath. That's the primary intention. Again and again, 5 minutes, 10 minutes. Bring in some kindness, some compassion, some care. This active idea of how can I work with this? What can I bring? What are the paramis that I can bring to this quality so that the perception shifts a little bit? So Mara loses some of the edge of the worry. How can I manage this a little bit? sometimes also if we're working with the opening to the whole body, being more dynamic with the attention, with the body scan, with restlessness and worry, specifically restlessness, there can be a bit more energy in the system. So it's good in the meditation if you find ways of using that energy for something. So I find if I'm feeling a little bit restless, I might do a body scan that just then sweeps through the body, sweeps back down through the front of the body, and again, up through the back, down through the front. And then there's something in that dynamism and giving the mind something to do. It's like the energy of the restlessness is used for something. It's like, ah, that's the appropriate sort of energetic level to respond to the restlessness. And it doesn't have to be a body scan. It could be doing metta practice, and it's like, ah, actually, there's a bit of energy, a bit of restlessness. Let me really bring that to the frequency of the phrases, if you're working with the phrases. Bring that intensity of the restlessness. May you be safe and protected. May you be well. May you be happy. And just kind of letting the energy find its way, find its expression, appropriate pitch in the meditation practice and through the technique. And again, something to play with. And I mentioned earlier that the worries can be, can be seductive. There's this idea, this promise of the worries, that if I worry enough, something will get resolved. Questioning that, like, where will this take me? What's the result of this worry? Finally, doubt. So here in the context of the hindrances, this means paralyzing doubt, getting caught up in the, for example, in the undecidedness of what should I practice? It's a silent meditation. What should I practice? Which technique do I choose? Is this the right way of doing it? Can I do this? Maybe I should have gone to that other retreat. They had more movement and dancing. Maybe that's the right thing for me. The doubt enters. Recognizing the doubt as doubt. This is really, again, the headline for each of the hindrances. So easily, the momentum of the hindrances flies under the radar. We don't notice it. So the mindfulness of noticing, like, ah, this is what's happening. This is why things feel so difficult. There's one of the hindrances. Doubt is present. It's active. I keep thinking about these thoughts. The mind is caught up in this spiral of doubting. So sometimes it can be useful to resolve, to come back to the doubt. Some of the doubts can be, you know, the mind brings up something that's actually completely appropriate question of like, actually, do I understand this thing? This feels a little bit questionable, this idea that I'm hearing or that I'm holding. Resolving to come back and clarify the doubt outside of the meditation. So if it's in the meditation sitting and you're there, oh, I could sit and think about this question for 45 minutes. You can choose, actually, I'll just bring it to the group with James, or bring it to a one-to-one, or check it out with someone after the retreat, or read about it. And I'm going to sideline it now. And now I'm really going to stay with the body, with the compassion, with the metta, with whatever practice I'm choosing. And this is actually quite a powerful skill, and there's quite a deep freedom in cultivating this capacity to put something down. It's like when we culturally, when we think about freedom, it's not the obvious freedom that we would think about, the freedom to not think about something. But actually, as you meditate, you realize there's actually quite a lot of freedom, a real profound felt sense of freedom in choosing. Actually, I don't have to think about this thing. I don't have to worry about it. I don't have to doubt it. And every time we're practicing with the hindrances, with the doubt, for example, we're developing that capacity, building that, strengthening that capacity. We're feeding it. It's like, okay, I'm recognizing this doubt as doubt, developing that wisdom. So that's what I wanted to offer in terms of the papancha and the hindrances. This was the unpleasant aspects of practicing on retreat talk. I thought about squeezing in body pain, working with body pain as well, and I thought, it's too much. So perhaps to be revisited, we'll see. I wanted to finish with a beautiful poem to sort of offset and balance things a little bit. This is from a poet called Mary Oliver, and the poem is called Snow Geese, and it's about delight. Snow geese. Oh, to love what is lovely and will not last. What a task to ask of anything or anyone. Yet it is ours, and not by the century or the year, but by the hours. One fall day I heard above me and above the sting of the wind a sound I did not know, and my look shot upward. It was a flock of snow geese winging it faster than the ones we usually see. And being the colour of snow, catching the sun, so they were, in part at least, golden. I held my breath, as we do sometimes, to stop time when something wonderful has touched us. As with a match which is lit and bright, but does not hurt in the common way, but delightfully, as if delight were the most serious thing you ever felt. The geese flew on. I have never seen them again. Maybe I will, someday, somewhere. Maybe I won't. It doesn't matter. What matters is that when I saw them as through the veil, secretly, joyfully, clearly. Have some moments of quiet. Thank you for your presence and your attention and practice. We now have half an hour for walking meditation, and then we'll meet back here for the last session of the day.